3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your hands.
A very good morning to you. Welcome to Friday Breakfasts, live from Friends of the Earth. We're here at 312 Smith Street in Fitzroy. You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM. You might be listening to us online or via digital radio. It's just Philippe and Jim this morning. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Philippe.
Yeah, Tara is unfortunately a little bit sick this morning. She can't join us, but we're going to have a good time anyway, aren't we, Jim?
We plan to, yes.
Yeah, it's going to be a fantastic show. How's your week been, by the way? What's been happening in your week?
My week's been good. I'm feeling healthy. Lots of people are sick, I've noticed.
Including one of our co-hosts.
All the sick people at home, you have our sympathy.
Yeah, we're going to be having some really fun and healthy food as well. And speaking of food, we're going to be talking about many wonderful foodie things very soon. We're looking at what's on the menu here at the Friends of the Earth. But what else is happening this morning, Jim?
We'll be having a chat to Ajak, who is a South Sudanese storyteller and musician.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing from her.
Yeah, that'll be cool.
We're also going to be hearing from Gregory Crozzetti and Briny Barr from the Scale Free Network, an art science collective that explores really interesting symbiotic relationships between microorganisms in the Great Barrier Reef and the impact of climate change in that area.
And then we'll hear from Anthony about the Friends of the Earth Land and Water campaign, talking about pesticide use in water catchment areas.
And we'll also be hearing from Ellie Watts, who's a volunteer slash intern at Compost Cycles, a really interesting little initiative put on by Cultivating Community. They offer residents and businesses a kind of user pays bicycle pickup service to process food waste from cafes and catering companies at local composting sites. And we're also going to have some live music as well later on from Rose Turtle Ertler and her lovely ukulele, hopefully, as well. But here on Friday Breakfast, we should get into what's on the menu.
What's on the menu?
Breakfast, Friends of the Earth. What's on the menu today? Is it beans? Is it greens? Is it shrooms? Is it carrots? Breakfast, Friends of the Earth. Here, right now.
And with it being Friday breakfast, obviously a good time to have some good food. Beth from the Friends of the Earth is here to tell us what's on the menu.
Hey, good how morning. Are you going? Good morning to everybody.
Yes.
Today we have a quinoa apple cinnamon bake with koyo yogurt. What else have I got on? We've got muffins today and scones.
My mouth is just salivating while you're just saying all this, Beth. It's amazing. Amazing stuff. Kiwa. What exactly is kiwa? I don't think I've ever had kiwa before.
Well, today you're going to try it.
Okay.
it's controversy is how to say it, I think, more than anything. Isn't it?
Like, I see. Have you ever had kiwa, Jim?
It's quinoa.
Quinoa, sorry. I do apologise.
Get it right.
Yeah, I have had quinoa just a couple of times. Is that a superfood?
Yeah, I suppose it's high in protein. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, like for those things, all the great things, but also environmentally, it grows well in dry climate and can sustain itself. So.
Oh, true.
But there's a great Tasmanian one, but as well, that's the only place in Australia that's grown, so that's a pretty good one. Mm. But anyway, you'll all try it today, so come on down, enjoy breakfast today.
Get down. And what's been your favourite breakfast meal this week, Beth?
I really did like the scrambled tofu that Michaela made yesterday. It was beautiful. Mm. And the pancakes were really... That's all been really lovely, actually, yeah.
Cool. Well, Beth, thank you so much for coming in on each and every sustainable breakfast and telling us what's on the menu this week. It's really salivating and mouthwatering. I actually heard you a couple of days ago talking about the scrambled tofu, and it just sounded amazing. Such amazing food down here at Friends of the Earth.
I know.
Yeah. So if people do want to come down, head on down. You'll meet us. You'll meet a whole bunch of people making really good food for you. We're at 312 Smith Street in Fitzroy. It's the Friends of the Earth Cafe. There's signs and everything outside. And we're going to be enjoying some really wonderful breakfast soon. Let's get into the front page.
The front page, where 3CR Breakfast explores what's being reported and what's not in Australia's mainstream media. How the media prioritise the day's news, including issues of bias, corporate influence, and who gets a voice and who doesn't. Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 8 a.m. A critical analysis of the nation's newspapers.
And you are here on Sustainable Breakfast, the last one of our fantastic series this week that's been going on here at Friends of the Earth. We're at 312 Smith Street. Come on down. Smith Street, Fitzroy, to be exact. Time to delve into the papers. We're only going to be doing one front page this morning because we are stacked with awesome stuff. But we do mention what's in the news at around about this time every Friday breakfast. And, well, Jim, it's been, I think, a really sad morning to read the papers. I'd probably even go so far to say to avoid the papers if you're not really wanting to see some really tragic stories on the front page. There have been revelations about Jill Maher's murderer used as a wraparound on the Herald Sun this morning. There's about 8 pages of coverage. And then when you get to the actual paper, on its actual front page, there is coverage about the murder of Masa Vukotic as well, regarding her funeral. It's really quite sad reading. I won't dwell on it too much, except to say in the editorial of the Herald Sun, there have been some really... I don't know how to describe it. Just really weird opinion articles. One being the editorial system, very much focused on how there should be a much more harsher justice system. There was one particular article by Rita Panahi talking about how that one solution has to be... that the punishment should fit the crime, or she was alluding to that. Obviously, the issue is much more complex than basically trying to, you know, say that a punishment has to fit a crime for a particular criminal. There's so much more that can be, you know, looked into, the chances for rehabilitation, the education system, that they're kind of being... been trying to fight against, I suppose. You know, so many circumstances surrounding a particular sentence, and there's nothing issued in the Herald Sun as a solution. It's a very complex issue, I do admit, and sometimes it can be a bit difficult to write about, but I think it's really... I don't know, I feel weird about seeing the kind of simplistic attitude to say, hey, we should really make sure that we come hard on criminals and in insignificant people like Jill Maher's murderer. Mm. Yeah, so I think, I mean, you know, I'll just quote something from Rita Panahi's article just quickly as well. The same people who attack decent, dedicated police for supposedly victim-blaming are the ones most likely to argue against harsher sentencing laws. They are eager to blame misogynist culture for violence. I mean, I think that's a large part of it. I don't think it's something that people are eager to blame misogynistic culture for violence. I think that's really not nice to say about people who... I mean, there is a misogynist attitude out there within society, I think. And there's certainly... And I'm really quite sad that Tara's not here to actually talk about this too. We probably should have had a female voice to discuss this more, and I feel weird as a man talking about this. But I just think that's really wrong to say something like that and say something simplistic as that about this issue. What's in The Age?
Yeah, The Age also had about half the newspaper dedicated to the story of this guy who killed Jill Maher. I won't really go into it, but the one thing I thought...
Yeah, it's been discussed a bit already. There.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing I thought was worth mentioning was an article on page 8 that just went into the, I guess, the response from the media and the police and kind of saying that while this was like such a horrible story, it in the public sort of consciousness it fits the narrative around rape, and like the state government put in heaps of funding for CCTV cameras.
I don't want to dwell on too much, but do you think that the media coverage that has kind of eventuated from this particular crime is out of proportion compared to the many other crimes that happen against women literally every day in domestic violence situations?
Yeah, well. yeah, exactly.
Like we don't see half or even probably three quarters of all the crimes against women in papers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's pretty much what this article was touching on. And yeah, you know, this funding went to extra CCTV, and meanwhile, there's all these domestic violence services that really need funding all the time. And so, yeah, just that it fits that narrative. But in the meantime, all this other stuff's going on around the same issues and not really getting much attention.
Let's quickly go to the Australian Financial Review. No RET deal better than bad deals, says the solar industry. Large-scale solar industry is fighting growing momentum to agree on a new renewable energy target, fearing it will lose out because its projects are not due. As care of a story from Philip Currie on its front page, the government is forcing Labor to, inverted quotes, crumble and agree to a renewable target of 32 kilowatts. Gigawatts per hour. It mentions also that what this means for the normal consumer, it will be a $10 saving. So essentially, there is savings, but not as much as many people would want to with this new renewable energy target that has been negotiated. They state that it will lose out because projects are not due to begin until the end of the decade. By then, wind will have used up most of the target, which uses cross subsidies to support production of wind, solar and other renewable energy sources. I'll leave it at that for the moment. Let's go to the Australian.
Yeah, in the Australian, there's a total of 3 exclusives on the front page and some classic Labor and union bashing.
Watchers to us here in this cafe will know that we have a running joke about how many exclusives the Australian can have in the front page each and every week. We try to see if it breaks its record.
Yeah, I think 3 to 4 is pretty standard.
Yeah, I saw about 6... once.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, actually, this article touches on an interesting issue, which is racism within unions. But basically, it's saying that this, in the New South Wales state election, Luke Foley, the Labor leader, and the CFMEU, this is a quote, dialed up the rhetoric against foreign ownership, raising national security concerns about Chinese state-owned firms controlling the state's transmission and distribution networks. And yeah, sort of, I guess, accusations of anti-Chinese sentiment. And I think that's a really, like, something that we should be really careful about and be onto. But also, there's no... I haven't seen this CFMEU campaign, but there's no quote from it, or there's no explanation of the connection between the Labor Party campaign and the CFMEU campaign. So anyway, people should keep their eyes out for that, perhaps.
That's the front page here on Friday Breakfast. Coming up very soon, we're going to be talking to Gregory Cocchetti and Bryony Barr from the Scale Free Network about their Art Science Collective. But that's coming up after this.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I love coming here because they offer vegan food.
Hi, my name's Paul. This is my first time at Friends of the Earth. I think it's really awesome and the food's great. Really healthy and nutritious.
Friends of the Earth Food Co-op, 312 Smith Street, Collingwood. A tuneful experience.
I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it.
Hey Jodie, I'm so excited, I just can't hide it.
Oh, just in the words of the Pointer Sisters, hey? Why? What's happening?
The new 3CR t-shirts are coming out. We had a competition, Kate Reid won it, and it's so beautiful. It's got roses and a love heart, and then the caption is, resistance is fertile.
Oh, too deadly that, eh?
So in order to get one, go to the 3CR website and follow the link to shop, and they're $30.
$30? Oh, what a bargain.
And $25 for kids. You'll be able to secure one for yourself because they're in hot demand.
Yay, get one now.
You are listening to 3CR 855 on the AM dial, or perhaps on the internet. It is Sustainability Week, and this is the Sustainable Breakfast Series. We are broadcasting live from Friends of the Earth Food Co-op, which is at 312 Smith Street, Fitzroy. If you're in the neighbourhood, you should get down. What's next, Philippe?
You're with Philippe and Jim. We have Gregory Crocetti and Bryony Barr here from the Scale Free Network.
Hi.
They are an art science collective that aims to be more than just about simply making books. And they have some fantastic projects going on. But we're going to be talking about a particular book that is being dubbed Symbiosis Storytelling. Welcome, Bryony and Gregory.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So firstly, could you just give us an idea of what the Scale Free Network actually defines itself as?
Okay, Scale Free Network is an art science collective, as you said, made up of myself, Gregory, and me, I'm an artist. And we work with a number of different artists and scientists and sometimes musicians and, you know, designers, whoever we can.
Teachers.
And teachers, yep. And we create different art science projects which look at the microscopic world and visualize, well, we like to say visualize the invisible using microscopes and using creative processes. So it could be drawing or it could be sculpture. And one of the things, we've done a lot of workshops with kids, with adults, with teachers, public installations in markets, you know, using microscopes, and we've done shows in galleries and things like that. But most recently, we've started using storytelling as a way to visualize the invisible world of microbes and their amazing symbiotic relationships that they have with us and many other forms of life.
The idea of an art science collective is intriguing to me because when I think of art, a lot of the time it not necessarily sees itself in the same world as science. I mean, a lot of the time when people see art, it's either a statement by the artist themselves or simply something that's not necessarily too politically motivated. Although I am seeing art more nowadays that is doing that. Are you seeing this as a movement within the art community to ensure that science is addressed as an issue?
There is a growing trend of artists engaging with scientific concepts and politically as well. You're right to suggest. I think artists are just opening their eyes a little bit more. Science is becoming more and more, and technology becoming more and more immersed into our lives. And so artists just respond to what's being discussed, what's, you know, being on TV, what's relevant to human beings. And so that's why I think arts, science goes together now better than ever. But that's, you know, not to forget centuries of, or millennia really, of those sort of Renaissance thinkers, the Da Vinci's, if you will, of people who were polymaths and great in all sorts of disciplines. Because art and science really have so much in common when you think about, they both observe the world and respond to that. They're both inherently creative, even though, you know, we always think of artists as the creatives and scientists as not creative. Science, that's bullshit, because science is inherently creative. Mm-hmm. They both do research. Anything else, Bernie?
Yeah, I think both artists and scientists ask questions about the world and, you know, communicate about the world, whether it's on a personal level or a political level or on a scientific level. And I think, there's a... increasing amounts of money actually funding for the fusion of arts and science, which is great, and artists can be part of communicating some of the more complex science issues to a broader audience perhaps, and that's, you know, one of the things we're interested in doing, and I think that's important in today's times when, you know, there's a lot of understanding science, or public understanding of science does help us, you know, have opinions on major issues.
Can you tell us about getting into a headspace to communicate these ideas to children?
I think we're still children, so in some ways, so that's
we all
easy.
Have a child inside of us.
Yeah. Embrace that.
All young at heart. That's a philosophy
there.
I love.
But I've worked a lot with children, and I work at a place called Art Play, and Gregory also, you know, has a teaching degree, I think that's, you know, we've done a lot of workshops with children, and that's how we formulated our collective really, is through developing workshops, although we do like to work with adults as well. But, you know, children are the next generation, and we want them to think about some of the ideas that we feel passionate about. So specifically, in the case of the books, that's the microbial symbiosis theme, the idea that cooperation is just as much of a part of life as competition or survival of the fittest. And that cooperation, between ourselves and other animals and these very small friends, we like to call them, is a very fundamental part of life. And so we like to communicate that, which to find ways to communicate that world, to visualise that world for our children.
I love many of your projects and one of them being Zobi and the Zooks.
Yep.
I love the fact that you do have that title, Symbiosis Storytelling, associated with it as well. And you've explained a little bit about it there. Can you give us an idea about what in particular Zobi and the Zooks is about, and what exactly is so symbiotic about it, I suppose, if
yeah,
that makes sense.
Sure. So we often think of coral as an animal. People are doing pretty well if they think of it as that. If they know a little bit more, they often think of it as a symbiosis, a relationship, a living relationship between an animal and a plant. And I guess that's, you know, a little bit better, but in fact, the microscopic plant that's living inside coral is not actually a plant, it's something else altogether, a really obscure kingdom of life. But it is photosynthetic, and so these tiny little microscopic zooxanthellae, the zooks in the story, live inside the animal. There's about a million or more living inside the tissue of the coral, harvesting sunlight. So these hard corals always live in surface, shallow waters, where there is plenty of sunlight. And we thought that was the story we were going to tell, but one of our main scientific collaborators, Linda Blackall, who's a professor at Swinburne Uni, She challenged us to think about this very new symbiotic relationship within coral that's just been discovered, that's with rhizobia, which is a type of bacteria. And any farmers or keen gardeners out there will know that leguminous plants like soy and clover and things like that have rhizobia bacteria forming root nodules and fixing the nitrogen, and that those nitrogen-fixing bacteria are really, really, really important for soil. Lo and behold, they found them in coral, and there's always been this unanswered question of where the nitrogen on the reef comes from, who's fixing it. And we thought it was cyanobacteria, but it turns out it's mostly these rhizobia in the coral. And so it's a beautiful three-way relationship between this large animal, well, a tiny coral polyp is hardly large, but large compared to the bacteria and these zooxanthellae living inside it that fix the carbon and the nitrogen, that forms a very nice closed system that is the backbone of the reef.
It's a beautiful little coral, well, we call it a coral society, bit of a riff on the, you know, coral society, but yeah, just all these trillions of microorganisms working together to, you know, maintain a balance inside each coral polyp, inside every colony, inside every, you know, part of the reef.
You try to reflect symbiosis in the creative team behind the storybook. Can you, in this particular book, Zobia and the Zooks, you did also collaborate with a couple of writers as well. Can you explain how you get your ideas across to people in that creative space who may not be, for the want of a better term, well-versed in the science of the coral reefs?
Yep. So my background is art, not science, so I'm one of those people as well who need the science to be broken down. And we wrote both these two books in the series with a writer, Elsa Wild, and an artist, Aviva Reed. And Aviva Reed is actually she calls herself a visual ecologist, so she actually is an artist with a background in science as well, so that helps. I think our symbiotic sort of communication process is really one of a lot of, you know, iterative back and forth. And with Zobia and the Zooks, we went to the reef together, and we went to an organization called Reef Teach and, you know, went to a lecture there and went out to the reef with this marine biologist from Reef Teach. And then we spent a lot of time together looking at articles, you know, and separately reading articles, talking about ideas, brainstorming, you know, possible structures for the story. You know, even when we were on the reef, Elsa came up with a sort of a basic framework that we were then able to work from. And it's really a process of translation through from the pure science. So that's sort of Madeleine Van Oppen from the Australian Institute for Marine Science and Linda Blackall, a microbiologist from Swinburne. They are both sort of holding the absolute, you know, raw, you know, high science, I guess. And then Gregory understands that as a microbiologist and translates that through, you know. So with me, we work together to storyboard the story and that's also coming by it. So the story comes via Alsa's understanding of the science, and then Alsa and Gregory work on that together. And then, yeah, the storyboard comes out of that, and then we work out the best way to express, you know, the story. Yeah, it's a bit like a film, trying to visualize, like, how would you film this scene? You know, how can we best describe this? How much science does it need to say? You know, and then Linda's and Madeleine are in there. That wouldn't happen. You can't say that's a great story, but
sounds
you can't
like
say that. You know, it's
amazing amount of collaboration.
Yeah.
I think we are running out of time, but I just do want to ask just quickly about the many other projects that you do. Could you just briefly run through some of the other wonderful projects that, I mean, your website has really such an extensive network of things that the Scale Free Network do. Do you mind just going through?
One thing we're focusing on a lot at the moment is a project called Drawing Water, which is about taking samples from local water bodies, whether it's a creek, a river, a pond, and very small samples, and putting them under the microscope to visualise the microbes that are there. And it's going to be things like protozoa and algae and diatoms and maybe some bacteria, although we're not looking quite that closely. Observing the biodiversity at that scale is awe-inspiring for children especially, but adults haven't seen most of these life forms as well, very alien-like. And so it's a really amazing way to engage with, you know, you look at water and you think it's just this chemical, you know, medium. But it's all of those water bodies are full of life. And I think those, by appreciating what's there right under our fingertips, I think where it makes us more...
Less human-centric.
Yeah, less human-centric and more likely to not dump crap into that water and to appreciate the intrinsic value of what's alive in that.
And we're going to be doing a project at the Come Out Festival in Adelaide where we'll be specifically looking at the Torrens River and the life within that.
Well, thanks for coming to have a chat with us, Gregory and Bryony.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And people can check out some of this stuff on scalefreenetwork.com.au.
Thank you so much, Gregory and Bryony. You're listening to Friday Breakfast here on 3CR. It is the Sustainable Breakfast Series, the last one of the week. We are at 312 Smith Street in Fitzroy. Come on down, get some free food, get some awesome coffee, and have some good times as well. Coming up very soon, we're going to have Ajak Kwai coming soon.
Abiyati, Abiyati, and the lineage. moye na pitil bene karandenda kurandenda adengir wada pa wara jalta wani yalele kawajur ku pulare buar bay ku be wayet ye ku duan abu wadam yenu abu wati wani jalani dwadone ka
You're listening to 3CR, either on 855 AM, 3cr.org.au, or via digital radio. You're with Jim and Philippe here on Friday Breakfast, the last of the Sustainable Breakfast series here at Friends of the Earth. Please do come down, 312 Smith Street in Fitzroy. Got a wonderful crowd here already, having their coffees and having a good time.
And we just heard a song called Mayukdit, which is off Ajak Kwai's record of Cows, Women and War. And we are lucky to have Ajak with us right now at Friends of the Earth. She's a Dinka musician and storyteller living in Fitzroy. Ajak, tell us about Mayukdit.
I think this is a cow song because where I come from, the cow is so important for us. And we have been nomad for thousands of years. And they said we domesticated the cow in Egypt. And then we followed the Nile for hundreds of years. We end up in South Sudan where we are now. So cow is so important in our life. And this one is special. People get married with the cows. So if you are a young man, you don't have 100 cows, you can't get a girl.
Oh, right.
So this it was written by my uncle, Kolalier, and he composed so many songs, and this is just one of them. And he said, my bull is so precious than a woman. He makes women angry. So that is a song. It's a very traditional song, and I love that song. That's why I recorded, because it's supposed to come with a book.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great song. And so when was this recording done? Is this recent?
Yeah, it's one of my... I haven't had a CD for years. So my last CD was the year 2008. So this is just the second one.
Mm. And you've been in Melbourne for a few years?
I've been in Melbourne now for 6 years because I used to live in Tasmania before.
Yeah. And what projects have you been up to in Melbourne recently?
I've done so many. Yeah, I had a performance last year, end of last year, with this one at La Mama. It was a part of the exploration in La Mama. It was funded by Melbourne City Council. And I put a show on at a courthouse, and that was been really hard work, and that one was the stories were come out from the book and the CD, so that what I have been doing. And this one now is just about to come out, and another one is coming again. I have another CD coming out at the end of next month.
Yeah, wow. And so I was just having a little look at your website. Would you describe your music as a tool for social change?
I wouldn't say that, but it's, you know, I just want to make myself feel good, and that's why I say that, because there are great artists that have been singing about the changing and all that kind of stuff. But I think that intention for me is to coming from the war country. I think that what I really like to send that message through music, because if you point your finger into people and say, oh, you did that, nobody will listen. But if you do it in a good way, in an art way, people will listen to music. And even though I don't, some of the songs, they're not in English, they can still follow, because all I describe a lot of the song. So, yeah.
Ajak, I was wondering if you could explain the differences between, say, performing in your home country of South Sudan and performing here? Obviously, we have two very different music styles, both in countries where they're both distinctive styles. How did you adjust to maybe performing, say, at like the National Folk Festival, where there'd be a lot of artists that are probably doing so many things different to what you're doing?
Look, that's the beauty of the world, you know. You have to have a different thing, and people love something different. And it's a challenge for me when I first came here to perform. It's a different kind of expectation. Where I come from, music is just to make people happy. Nobody will judge you whether you don't think well or you sing well. Nobody cares, you know. People just have a good time. And here it's become a different kind of thing, and that is really a challenge. But actually, art is a world language, and it makes it easier for me to be able to collaborate with a lot of us Australian musicians. And so that it was a challenge, but actually people adopt a different thing quickly. I did through music.
So you sing in Arabic, Sudanese, and English.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a music nerd, so this is a nerdy question. But do you think those languages are suited to different styles of music, or have you found that?
Yeah, they're different. When I sing, like recently, I've been in Fort Ferry, and you know the people say, we never had that kind of music. It's very new to our ears. And so it's very different. But because I'm playing with Australian musicians, it's not pure African music as such, but it's based on my root, but actually it's world music, which is makes a lot of, you know, with a different kind of music.
Mm. And that's a really awesome thing that I find about Australian music. We don't have necessarily an identity of what Australian music is, unless you want. I mean, technically, you could identify Indigenous music here as the actual true music here of Australia. But there have been a lot of people who say that there has been music that has evolved throughout the history of Australia, and there's certainly, like, music like yours adds along to that. Do you find that there's like a sense of curiosity of people wanting to find out more about where you come from in terms of how you make your music?
Yeah, people are interested. It's particularly the world is becoming smaller now through art, and a lot of people are curious to know what kind of music others people playing. And actually, a lot of African music influence the whole world music, and it's really good that, you know, we contribute so much to the world. We never acknowledge, but actually, through music, it's a one of acknowledgement you could tell. But apart from that, so it's very good. It's very good that, you know, we mix with other people, and people are very curious to know. Particularly, even from Africa background, Africa is a big country, and I come from North Africa, which is totally different from South Africa and West Africa as well. So I got influence from Arab countries, because Sudan is supposed to be an Arab country by such a culture. So it's a different thing again. So people are related to the music.
Mm. And we had a brief chat on the phone the other day, and when I mentioned it was Sustainability Week, you were telling me a little bit about the changing food culture in your home country. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, in my country, you know, when I first came to Australia, it was very hard for me to find food to eat. It was one of the difficult, I still find it hard until today. And not only me, but a lot of people, even though I come from a poor country, I find the food is really poor here. When I first came here, I went to the supermarket and I bought tomato, and I look at it and I said, a friend of mine, we came from Egypt, and it tastes like a mud. I never forget about that. And everything we go and buy, it doesn't taste like where we came from. Mm. And because in Sudan, the food was very real, you know, it's organic. We never had any chemical at all. And we have been a farmers for a hundred of years, like with our animal. We never have money, we never have a job or something. So it's very different, but now it's very different because a lot of people are farming now. In Sudan, it's a great, South Sudan, everyone in the whole world now want to farming in South Sudan, and they're going to ruin that place. They're going to put the chemical in it. They're going to, and if the agriculture chemical go to the River Nile, and then that would be a disaster for us. So the culture changed in South Sudan so much. Even now, it's so everyone want to farming there, and the same thing here related to my home, my new home Australia. I think the food is very important, and I really people are very rich in Australia. And I don't understand why people prefer to have money and don't have a good food. This is something I really find it hard.
Mm. Well, Jack, thank you so much for coming in. We unfortunately have to wrap up. Thank you so much. We were wanting you to perform, but obviously you're not feeling the best today. So we'll have another listen to another track off of Cows, Women and War. I believe this is called The Father. Can you just briefly tell us what it's about?
It's a spiritual song. Yeah.
Okay, simply that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Ajak Kwai. Thank Ajak, please.
Thanks, mate. Just heard The Father by Ajak Kwai. You're listening to 3CR 855 on the AM dial or the internet. And we're coming to you live from Friends of the Earth Food Co-op for the Sustainable Brekkie series. We're at Friends of the Earth, which is at 312 Smith Street, Fitzroy. And if you come down, you can join us for free breakfast.
We have here Anthony Amos from the Friends of the Earth Land and Water Campaign to talk about pesticide use in the water catchment areas, as well as Melbourne water in general. Welcome, Anthony. Thank you so much for coming.
Hi.
Anthony, I'm intrigued by your history with Friends of the Earth, so I was wondering if you could possibly just give us a little bit of history of how you got involved with the folks here at Friends of the Earth.
I first got involved in forest campaigning back about 20-something years ago now, actually. So I was a forest campaigner for some time. Then I got interested in issues surrounding plantation management. And then from that I've sort of branched out into chemicals, because there's a whole history there of people, particularly across Victoria, who were exposed to high levels of toxic chemicals back in the 70s and 60s and 70s and 80s. That were sprayed on pine plantations, including 2,4,5-T, the infamous herbicide defoliant that was used in Vietnam. It was also used throughout Victoria.
Where was these in pesticides? Well, where were these being infected? Like,
well,
in Melbourne.
2,4,5-T was used across Victoria since the late 1940s.
Oh, wow.
And then in the 70s, there was a range of birth deformities that occurred at Yarram in South Gippsland. There was also concerns at Sale, and there was some other clusters that were happening around the state. So there was a lot of issues. It was a huge political issue back in the late 1970s that was never really resolved. Not only in Victoria, it was also occurring across Australia as well. And more recently, there was some spray workers up near Derby in Western Australia who had a whole range of health problems and cancers and all sorts of problems there that have been associated with them using these herbicides.
How much is the usage of pesticides impacting the environment nowadays compared to the days of the 70s and 80s? Has it reduced?
It's worse. No, it's increasing almost exponentially. So the variety of pesticides out there, it's enormous. And to get your head around it, it's really quite an onerous task, actually. So in Melbourne's water supplies, if you live in the north and the west of the city, you'll be getting your drinking water from Sugarloaf Reservoir. So, and Sugarloaf is the only reservoir in the Melbourne supply that draws water directly from the Yarra River. And upstream of where they pump out the water, I don't know if you've been up around Sylvan or up in all that country up there, there's about 10,000 hectares of intensively farmed agriculture. So when these agricultural sprays are sprayed on the crops, a portion of that whatever sprayed ends up in the creeks and flows down into the Yarra. So there was a study done in 2009, the most comprehensive study done in Victoria ever. And yeah, they found 48 different pesticides in the waterways of the upper Yarra. And potentially that's all flowing past the, where we pump our drinking water from. So, and at the actual offtake where the water's pumped, they've detected about a dozen different pesticides.
How much of a health impact does this have for people who live in the north and I believe it was the west of Melbourne?
Well, the issue then is if it's pumped out of the river, then it's stored for a time in the reservoir, and then it has to go through the treatment process. So
yeah, I was about to ask, like, how effective is that treatment process?
Well, the treatment used at the Winicky treatment process, it uses sort of granular and sand filters. So it's not was never designed to eliminate pesticides. The issue I've got is that the and what this where the science is heading now is that they're saying very very low doses of pesticides are potentially having impacts that weren't necessarily factored in when safe guideline levels were actually created. So even minute traces of pesticides could be having potential health problems on endocrine function in people who drink the water. And then you've got the Shandian effect. There's not only potential pesticides, there's impacts from fluoride and chlorine and all the rest of it that goes in the drinking water as well.
There have been like many articles and a series of studies that have gone on since the 1980s. I have something here from yourself by the Friends of the Earth Australia website that states that Ballarat Courier ran a series of articles concerning ill health work of workers who were involved in the spraying of herbicides, which you kind of also gave us a little bit of a background out from the 60s to the 80s. Is there any action to any of these reports? If the usage of pesticides and herbicides on land is increasing exponentially, why isn't anything done about it from either the government or anyone else?
Well, the government regulator who regulates pesticides in Australia, the Australian Pesticides Veterinary Medicines Association, all their entire budget is sourced from chemical sales. So the more chemical sales that are made, the more goes into their coffers. So the problem is that they're not independent of the actual sale of chemicals. So therefore, they're not likely to ban a pesticide if it's a fair part of their of their revenue stream. So that's the first problem, and the second problem is that a lot of monitoring, because this issue is so complex, the state governments do a bit of monitoring here and there, but basically we're all being used as guinea pigs, essentially, and a lot of the health problems don't occur till 20 or 30 years after exposure. So how do you actually prove that the chemicals have caused it in the first place? But those spray workers at Ballarat, and yeah, there's going to be an inquiry. The new state government is setting up an inquiry there, so those old guys might get a bit of justice, but I think like 80% of them have passed away already.
At a base level, finally, can you explain what the ordinary citizen can do to basically ensure that they eat food that hasn't been infected by pesticides or herbicides? Well, I'm assuming organic food would be an option.
Yeah, well, buy organic. And particularly if you've got children, children up to the age of 7 are highly susceptible to the organophosphate type of pesticides. So if you've got kids, I'd argue don't eat anything but organic produce. Particularly up to 7 years old, and then after that, try as best you can. The big problem at the moment is glyphosate residues, and in the US, they're saying now that there's a whole range of health problems that are being caused by children being exposed to extremely low levels of glyphosate in the processed foods that they're eating. So, yeah.
Anthony, thank you so much for having a chat to us this morning on Friday Breakfast. Anthony Amos is from the Friends of the Earth Land and Water campaign. He was talking to us about pesticide use in the water catchment areas of Melbourne and Victoria. Please thank him.
Thank you.
Program sponsor, the New International Bookshop, for the financial support of this program. You can find NIBS in the basement of Trades Hall at 54 Victoria Street, Carlton.
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant, and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Do you want to get in contact with a socially progressive audience and diverse communities? Are you organising a forum, concert, festival, rally, call-out or film screening and want to let people know? Unlike other community radio stations, 3CR doesn't have commercial advertising, but we do offer not-for-profit, community and government organisations a chance to connect with 3CR's diverse and lively audience. Go to www.3cr.org.au and find out about our very affordable community announcements, or call 3CR on 9419 8377 and get your event on air.
You are listening to The Brekkie Show on 3CR with Philippe and Jim. And today we're coming to you live from Friends of the Earth Food Co-op for the Sustainable Brekkie series at 312 Smith Street, Fitzroy. There's a free breakfast happening here right now.
Yeah, it's the last one. I'm going to be so sad that this is going to be ending. I wish we could have sustainable breakfasts all the time, Jim.
Every Friday.
Man,
yeah.
You know, why can't we just set up our studios here?
I reckon
it'd be a bit impractical to do it in a cafe.
Yeah, I guess
so. Like all the time. But I enjoy it.
It's kind of nice, though.
Yeah,
it is. So cancel the McMuffin and get down to Friends of the Earth.
We're at 312 Smith Street here in Fitzroy.
Free breakfast. Go to work late. Tell your boss you had a flat tyre.
Indeed. We now have Ellie Watts, who is a volunteer and intern at Compost Cycles, a program initiative that is part of the Cultivating Community series of programs. It offers residents and businesses a user-pay bicycle pickup service to process food waste from cafes and catering companies and send that food to local composting sites. Welcome, Ellie. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Could you give us just a little bit of an idea of Cultivating Community in its, like, basic form? It is a conglomerate, well, not necessarily a conglomerate, but there's a lot of different programs involved with Cultivating Community. Is there, at the base level, like a modus operandi of what Cultivating Community is about?
So Cultivating Community, they aim to sort of target low-income communities to access and participate in a food system, like a sustainable food system. So to do that, they help people grow their own food through community gardens, and they also try and get people cooking and doing activities like that that get people engaged in the food system.
And like we mentioned, Compost Cycles is one of the programs that is involved with Cultivated Community. You yourself pick up a lot of these composts. What would be a typical day for you, essentially?
I'm generally in the office.
Okay.
I don't see compost a lot because we're working on trying to get this program up and running. It actually used to run before my time at Cultivating Community, so it ended mid last year. So in collaboration with Yarra City Council, it was run under the name Food Know How. So people, volunteers actually, would cycle around on these tricycles that have these big trailers on the back that can fit bins on it. And they would cycle around to cafes, pick up their food waste, and then cycle it to compost hubs. So there was one at the the Collingwood Children's Farm, and there was a few others around the place, different sorts. There was a worm farm, a few other sorts of composting systems. And so the food would be, the food waste would be composted there, and then it would be distributed to community gardens around the place.
How much is it a problem for cafes and restaurants in terms of their food waste? I mean, we see many larger corporations such as many of the takeaway outlets and I suppose you could say supermarkets as well have enormous amounts of food waste go to waste. And I think it's important that something like this gets up and happening. But how important is to have a realization of how much food waste there is being generated by these companies and restaurants and cafes?
Look, it's really important because when food waste goes to landfill, it causes methane and it's extremely problematic, and it's something that we can actually sort of put back into the food cycle, and making it into the compost means that we can use it to grow food again. So it's problematic in these cafes because they're producing a lot of food for us when we go in and have our food, but there's not really systems for that food waste to be sort of pushed back into natural systems again. There are a few services that you can get that will pick up food waste specifically, but nothing that sort of brings it back into the community where we're using it, essentially. This is where it's being wasted, so it's about bringing it back in now.
Mm. And there's always dumpster diving, of course, but we can't get through all that food waste.
Yeah. Exactly.
Wondering if you have any hot tips on composting for the listeners at home.
Oh, at home. I personally use a bokashi bin, which is excellent. You do need some space outside as well to recompost it, but if you can get a bokashi bin, it ferments the food waste. It means you can compost meats and dairy as well, which you normally can't compost. I highly recommend them.
And it gets the juice out, is that how it works?
Yeah, it has a juice which is also a complete fertiliser, so you can use that on your garden to help grow food.
And normally you wouldn't put meat and other things and other animal products in your compost?
No.
Yeah, I was about to say, are there anything that just is a no-no?
There are problems with putting that into your compost. You know, you can attract bad bacteria and or rats. Even rats. So it's best not to put those things straight into your compost, but using something like a bokashi bin, it will help to break down those things so you can compost them.
I was wondering if there's anything that consumers of cafes or restaurants can do to kind of alert local businesses to use their food waste effectively. Is it just simply as simple as just talking to the manager and saying, what do you do with your food waste?
Yeah, I mean, asking when you go in is definitely the best thing to do. Like, talk about, you know, what their services are, just to make them aware that people care about this sort of thing. Because if you don't bring it up and it's easy for them to put it into landfill, that's where it's going to go.
I was wondering if you could give us a bit of a description of the bicycles that you use. I have a picture in front of me which looks amazing. I can't explain. I was wondering if you could give us an idea of what these bicycles are like and how is it like to ride them.
Yeah, well, I haven't actually personally ridden one before, but we have a team of dedicated volunteers who love them. And so it's a tricycle, so it's okay. Like a...
So I have been referring to them wrongly as a bicycle. It's a Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
It serves the same purpose.
Yeah.
Just with an extra wheel.
And have they been custom made by you guys?
They have been custom made. I can't remember the name of the company that custom makes them, but they have a great little trailer on the back where you can fit the bins straight from the cafes. So the volunteers would ride around and give the cafe an empty bin and take a full bin.
So why a tricycle and not any other form of vehicle to collect compost?
Well, partially that would be to cut down on fossil fuels because...
It sounds an obvious question, but yeah, I'm intrigued.
Transporting the compost around, it's, you know, it could get a bit pricey and you know, for fossil fuels. But, yeah, it also provides a way that the volunteers can, you know, be seen, be visible. You know, you can see them riding on the very bright orange bikes down Smith Street. And it means that we're bringing it back, bringing the compost cycles back into visibility.
You mentioned earlier that you are currently having compost cyclers on the back burner, and at the present moment there isn't any collectors. Are you currently looking for volunteers, and is there anything that people can do to...
Yeah, so at the moment it's not running. So we're currently going through a mentorship with a company called Social Traders, and they do a program called The Crunch. And they take people through making a social enterprise and all the business details that you need to have worked out before you run a company. So we're looking to use that so that we can work out how to make this self-sustaining, so we don't need to have income from councils or grants to keep the business going.
Okay. Compost cyclers, if people want to find out more and do want to volunteer, or if they simply just want to get in contact with you, or if they're a cafe or business who might be listening to you and want to get involved, what should they do?
Go to the Cultivating Community website, and there's a tab there where there's where you can look at volunteering.
Ellie, thank you so much for having a chat to us this morning. Ellie Watts is a volunteer and intern at Compost Cyclers, who offer a whole bunch of user pay bicycle pickup services to process food waste from cafes and catering companies, and offers it to residents and businesses as well, and transfer them to local composting sites. Please thank Ellie.
Thank you very much.
You're on Friday Breakfast. This is the Sustainable Breakfast series. Coming up very soon, we're going to be hearing from Rose Turtle Ertler. Straight after this.
This is Irene Bolger, former Secretary of the Nurses Federation in Victoria. Throughout the Nurses Dispute in 1986 and the Waterfront Dispute in 1998, 3CR was always there, broadcasting the voices of workers in struggle.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, and we're broadcasting live from the Bay to Chicken Strike here in Melbourne.
We've just seen all of the thousands of nurses walk through to their meeting, and people from different unions showing their solidarity.
3CR, radio for the workers, by the workers, since 1976.
You are listening to the Sustainable Breakfast Series, broadcasting live from Friends of the Earth Food Co-op. We're here at 312 Smith Street in Fitzroy. Please come on down. We are coming towards the end of the program, though. It's going to be really sad to leave here. Anyway, you're listening to Philippe and Jim.
Yes, and considering we are at Friends of the Earth right now, I thought it would be worth mentioning that Friends of the Earth Melbourne is having its 40th birthday party on Friday the 8th of May at the Circus Oz Spiegel Tent, which will be next to the Tote in Collingwood. There will be sugar-fed leopards, glitter rats, Black Orchard, string band, Lynn Kent, and Sammy Hoopstar.
I believe, Jim, that you're part of that lineup somewhere, somehow. Is that right?
That's true.
So if people want to actually see your face perform.
Yeah.
Oh, not necessarily your face perform, but...
my whole body, including my face.
Yes. You'll be at this event?
Yeah, I will. Looks real fun. I'm going to be there. It's the Spiegel tent. I've never been in the Spiegel tent, but apparently that's a cool thing.
I have been at the Spiegel tent for something different that Circus Oz put on about 9 months ago, and it's an amazing venue. Mm. Brilliant venue. I could not recommend highly enough people go to this simply to experience the venue.
Yeah. So you can, if you want to come to the Friends of the Earth Melbourne 40th birthday party, you can buy tickets online at a Facebook event. I guess you search that on Facebook, or you can come down to Faux, which is at 312 Smith Street, Collingwood, or you can just come on the night and get involved.
Awesome stuff. That's the Friends of the Earth 40th party. You're listening to Sustainable Breakfast here on a Friday morning. You're with Philippe and Jim. We have a special musical guest now, Rose Turtle Ertler, with her wonderful uke. Welcome, Rose, to the program
thank
this morning.
You. I've also got Morgan, Morganics.
But thank you so much for coming down here at Friends of the Earth. You've got your little uke, you've got the spoken word of Morganics. Tell us what you're going to play for us.
I'm going to play a song about the end of the world.
No, fun, happy topic.
Just a good sort of early morning song.
All right, take it away.
It's about a storm. As long as we stay together, we'll be all right. 2, 3, 4.
After the storm had calmed and had a minute to catch his breath, took the time to look around and see what a terrible, terrible mess. Sorry, he cried as he swept all the leaves and repaired the broken limbs. I will rest on my land and feel the air with slowness and try to make amends. I will try.
You're listening to 3CR. This is the Friday Brekkie Show. We're coming at you live from Friends of the Earth. You just heard Rose Turtle Ertler and Monix playing live at Friends of the Earth.
This is a song about the stars. The stars bring us all together. Just cut us off. Or tell us when we need to stop.
I'm
nothing like a live, awesome fade out right there. Yeah, fade out. Yeah, good. Love. Thank you so much, Rose. Thank you, Morganics, and thank you, Ronnie, as well. Yeah, thank him again.
And we got to wrap up here at Friday Brekkie. Just like to thank all our guests today. We had Gregory and Bryony from the Scale Free Network, Ajak Kwai, the Dinka musician and storyteller, Anthony Amos, the Friends of the Earth Land and Water campaigner. We had Ellie from Compost Cycles, and of course you just heard Rose Turtle Ertler and Morganics and Ronnie.
And we have so many other people to thank as well. We should thank Friends of the Earth for all their coffee and breakfast. Please give them a round for this week. They provided some really great breakfasts this week.
Fantastic lattes.
We should also thank the City of Yarra for their support for putting sustainable breakfast on. We should also thank a lot of people here at 3CR as well. Thanks to Michael, who's been doing sound for us throughout this whole week. We should also obviously thank all the staff at 3CR for their support. Thank you to Elena McMaster for putting this whole thing together. Elena has been pretty much the star of the Sustainable Breakfast series, and like this whole broadcast wouldn't be here without her support. And we want to thank you, the listeners, as well. So thank you so much for your support. We'll see you next week here on Friday Breakfast from the studio. We better head to the studio now to hear from Beyond Zero. Once again, we'll see you later.
See ya.
You've been listening to 3CR Breakfast, community news and independent current affairs.
I'm Claire Burns,
Adrian Wong,
Diana Beaumont,
Caden Nick,
Rihanna Whitson,
Ron and Dean,
Katie Weiss,
the uranium mining area,
shake-up of the Australian Defence Force.
It's women who seem to miss out yet again.
Coal-fired power station,
carbon price mechanism,
ongoing protests in Egypt.
Some current affairs goodness for you this morning.
3CR's Tuesday Breakfast Show.
Wednesday Breakfast.
Thursday Breakfast.
Friday Breakfast.
We've got a massive show today.
Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m. on 3CR Digital, 855 on the AM dial, and streaming live at 3cr.org.au.